Paul Nolan, we're here third year in a row, third Northern Ireland peace monitoring report in a row. What are the big kind of headlines that when we read into Northern Ireland?
Well, what I've done is I've tried to draw out the 10 key points. And if you want to sort of reduce it further into, well, okay, that's the 10, what are the
What's
three?
The headline?
I think they'd do firstly with... Well, first of all, there's an issue to do with educational underachievement, and along with that, an issue about high levels of educational attainment. And these are two different stories. And the way that the pattern is emerging is one that shows that some people are doing very well through our education system, or to put that more correctly, through our two education systems. The people who are doing best are Catholic girls. And in particular, Catholic girls who are not disadvantaged, i.e. who are not eligible for free school meals. And they're doing incredibly well. I mean, really quite remarkable levels of success. When I looked at their level of attainment using the standard measure for educational attainment, which is five good GCSEs, including English and maths, not only are they doing best in Northern Ireland, they're actually at the top of the attainment tree when you compare them with other social groups in England. In England, the attainment ladder has Chinese at the top. Chinese kids do best of all the social groups in England. And Catholic girls from Northern Ireland, if you were to compare them using that measure, they're up there with the Chinese. In fact, they actually beat the Chinese, and they're only pipped for the very top position by Chinese girls. So that's how well they're doing. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have Protestant boys who have free school meal entitlement, i.e. who live in areas of social deprivation, and the gap between them and the very successful Catholic girls we talked about is actually a full 57 percentage points. That's a big difference. But
I mean, in the diagram in the report, the Catholic girls are at the top.
And the Protestant, at the bottom. And who's at the bottom in England? Well, at the very bottom, really, you've got, first of all, white boys who are on free school meal entitlement who have been perceived to be a problem for social cohesion in Britain for many years. And because of that, there is a pupil premium to direct some resources that way. And actually, on the data sets I looked at, are Protestant boys on free school meal entitlement do even less well than those white boys in free school meals in England. In fact, they're only just ahead of two other social groups, and they are Irish travellers and Roma. Now, I should emphasise that you can't say this with any precision. These are approximations because they're different data sets, and they are computed slightly differently. For example, there's different entitlement arrangements for free school meals in Northern Ireland than in England. So there are some differences. But while you can't say it with any precision, what we can be very clear about, and it is very clear, is that there is a huge attainment gap in Northern Ireland, and we are building a badly skewed society because we have a meritocracy, we have an equal opportunities culture, and what this means is that some people, if they've got the qualifications, will do very well, and other people who don't have those qualifications will do less well, and a lot less well.
So we see this kind of carrying on from kind of second level education and third level as well. So we see in terms of universities and degrees.
Yeah, you see the pattern very clearly at higher education, where the ratio of Catholics to Protestants in higher education is 3-2. In other words, we've got Catholics predominating in higher education. And not just Catholics, but there's also a gender bias to this, in that girls do better than boys in schools and in university. So it's roughly 60-40 female-male in our university. So if you look at how these different variables act upon each other, you get a compound effect where you take gender and class and religion together, and Catholic girls who are not disadvantaged do extremely well, and Protestant boys who are socially or economically disadvantaged do particularly badly. And it does leave them locked out of the labour market. And what we see this year, for the first time actually, is when you look at percentages of unemployment amongst young people under 24, The percentage of young Protestants, 24%, is higher than the percentage of young Catholics, 17%. So we can see what's happening here.
It's because there's never a chance to catch up once you've missed the boat. It's very difficult to get back on again.
Yeah, well, there is a saying in education, if at first you don't succeed, you don't succeed. And that is proving to be the case. Now, if you look at, well, what does that mean for this society? What it means is we're, you know, we're laying down a seedbed of trouble for the future, because that degree of alienation that comes from being locked out of the labour market and therefore being socially excluded, to use the jargon phrase in other ways, eventually that bubbles up somewhere. And what we've got at the moment is a problem that perhaps isn't so different from a problem that was experienced in England, say, 2 years ago with the riots, where it was the same factors, perhaps, i.e. young people who felt that they had no roots out of their poverty. We had riots in all the, well, in some of the major English cities. Now, if those same factors were present here in Northern Ireland, and they are, you might get the same result, i.e. social unrest. You might get riots. They just wouldn't look the same here, because here they would take a sectarian form. And here, that's what we've had. We've had a run of social unrest that began with the Flags protest, but has now continued on. And it seems set to continue for some time.
Yeah, and you could link that kind of deprivation and kind of education gap that's kind of growing, you could link that with the demographics that are very much changing. You've kind of said the city of Belfast has kind of since tipped over the last few years in terms of its demographics.
Yeah, we reached a tipping point there somewhere between the 2001 census and the 2011 census. And what happened, it's very simple actually. We had a city that historically always had a Protestant majority. That no longer has a Protestant majority. The Catholics are not the majority in the sense of being over 50%. They're somewhat under that, you know, 48%. But what we've got is a city where the largest population share is Catholic. And that census result happened by coincidence to be published the week after the City Council decision. So it's not as if the young people who come out in the streets read the census and then decided to riot, but sometimes, you know, people can act like human sensors. They pick up the earthquake. They pick up the vibration. And the earthquake that was happening was that Belfast had changed, and changed from a Protestant city to a city that will not again in the future ever have a Protestant majority, at least not in the foreseeable future, because the new city boundaries of the new enlarged council show again an inbuilt bias towards the Catholic population.
I mean, the Peace Monitoring Report, you know, it's 100 or so pages long.
184,
so nearly 200. I mean, it's kind of part statistical almanac, kind of pulling together things from different places, part kind of annual report card for Northern Ireland. Sometimes you feel a bit like the man who kind of calls out the naked emperors, you know, and says, you know, here's something that is so obvious. Statistically, it's there. Anecdotally, it's there. But politically, that we just ignore and solve some other second-class issue rather than actually dealing with the big problems?
It's an annual publication, and there's a purpose to that in a way. It's a bit like if you're looking at the hands of a clock, what journalists have to do most of the time is look at the big hand. And what we do here is we look at the small hand. And actually, in many ways, that's the more important one, because you see the big changes. The things that may not be so obvious if you're reporting what happened between, you know, 12 o'clock yesterday and 12 o'clock today.
But that 10 or 20 year trend period.
Yeah, but what this tries to do is look at the deeper trends to see, well, what's the overall direction for this society? Where are we heading? And to try to see, I mean, if you consider it, to change the metaphor, as a sort of x-ray of the society, what we're trying to do is see, well, where are the likely problems? Where can we see those deeper stresses that might erupt because of unemployment or the impact of the recession or the arrival of the new communities? What's really happening? What are the bigger trends here? And the census, of course, does provide that big picture, which is why I put so much focus on it in last year's report, again in this year's report.
Part of the long-term trend, we can see household crime continues to reduce. In fact, crime overall seems to be reducing, even despite flag protests, when you just said there was a lot of disorder, but that's kind of invisible nearly in the stats.
Well, People don't talk about it very much, but if you live here, you may even be unaware of it, but Northern Ireland is quite remarkably, I won't say peaceful, and I won't even say crime-free, but compared to other parts of these islands, it's quite remarkable how low our crime levels are. I'm talking about, if you like, ordinary decent crime, i.e. not security-related crime. And that has been decreasing year on year. Now, it's actually been decreasing in England and the Republic of Ireland as well. And in fact, it's been decreasing in the industrialised world for reasons that we can only speculate on and criminologists write about.
Yeah, less money around,
that's right. And actually, I mean, if you look at figures published last week in the Republic, quite a drop in crime, which relates to the recession. I mean, this is counterintuitive. And it's actually different than the recession in the 1980s when crime went up. But in the past recession, crime has gone down. In Dublin, for example, there's less money around for drugs. And because there's less money around for drugs, a lot of the drug gangs are in problems. What that leads to, actually, is an increase in burglary because they have to go into diversify.
Yes, they have to raise their money some other method.
But overall, violent crime is down in the Republic on things that are not related to the Dublin drug scene. And so, yes, there's been a decrease in crime everywhere, and we're the beneficiaries of that. But we started from a lower base, if you like. So yeah, Northern Ireland remains relatively peaceful society.
And yet we still have we have more police per head of population than the rest of the UK or Ireland.
We do.
Because we have more injured police per head of population as well.
Well, 1 in 10 of the PSNI were injured last year in confrontations arising out of the flags protest or the public disorder that followed the 12th of July. That just doesn't happen in England. Yes, we have more police per head of the population, but you have to look at some of the particular strains on policing here. You know, if the police in England get a call out to a burglary, it's pretty unlikely that there's a gunman lying in wait, or that there's a booby trap waiting to murder the police who go out to investigate. What that means in practical terms is before the police go out to investigate a reported crime, they have to check if it's a come-on call, and that requires quite a lot of additional policing. It used to be done by the army. It's not done by the army anymore. If you get situations like during the flags protest, where there was one night during the flags protest when there were 80 seats of protest, as they call them, 80 sites, that requires a lot of policing. And when you take something like, you know, the July disturbances, which went on for you know, 4 days, you do require more police. I mean, if you look at the size of our police force now, you know, under 7,000 compared to where we were in 1999 at the time of Patton, I mean, it's reduced dramatically.
You make the point that unionism or loyalism is nearly talking itself into a culture war, mm-hmm. to some extent.
Yeah.
That they may not. Is it that they're not under as much threat in terms of their as they realise, or just that they are feeling various other pressures and kind of seeing it as a
culture. The way it's perceived from within unionism is that there is a sustained attack upon unionist culture, unionist tradition. And the way that is seen is that while unionists are now reassured that there is no constitutional threat to Northern Ireland, i.e. the Good Friday Agreement did copper fasten the union, that's been accepted. The argument is that while the Republican campaign failed to take Northern Ireland out of Britain, they are now campaigning to take Britishness out of Northern Ireland. And if you look at the evidence for this, it actually doesn't sustain what sounds like it might be a good argument. Because, in fact, there were more Orange Marches last year than the year before, or the year before that, or the year before that. In fact, there were more Orange Marches last year than in the history of Orange Marches. There are more marching bands now than there ever were in the history of marching bands. if you look at the funding that's going to the Ulster Scots language, you know, £2.5 million last year. If you look at the money that has gone to support Orange Culture that has come from the European Union, massive grants for Belfast and Armagh. If you look at the money that has gone to the apprentice boys in Derry, and again, not just to European Union, but grants from the Irish government, grants from the IFI. If this is a war on Orange Culture, they seem to be winning it.
They certainly can't back up their thing economically, but they would still feel, from council decision, politically they feel yes. It's a war rather than maybe economically.
And if you construct the issues that arise in that zero-sum way, then all of these things can be seen as losses for unionism. If, for example, you regard having signage in public buildings bilingual, then every sign that goes up in the Irish language is a blow to unionism. And that is how it's perceived by quite a lot of people. I mean, as we know from the unionist walkout last week in the council, but it doesn't have to be seen that way. I mean, in Wales, for example, the fact that we have bilingual policies is not seen as a huge threat to Britishness. I mean, the two can coexist. But if you've decided in advance that any expression of Irish language or Irish culture is automatically a reduction of the unionist tradition, then you will see your culture to be under threat.
It's not true for all of the report, but for much of it, we end up in this kind of bipolar Protestants versus Catholics, nationalists versus unionists kind of way of measuring things. Now, yeah. Other is kind of creeping into the middle, and we can debate maybe what other is, but it's kind of somehow ironic that we're kind of sitting in CRC building talking about this. It's published through CRC, and actually we're the lens mm-hmm. through which society is seen is actually still very, very polarised.
Yes.
It's still very two sides.
And it can seem ironical and even paradoxical, and I'm very conscious of this, that if you're trying to be anti-sectarian, you end up looking at things in sectarian terms because you're trying to identify where the dynamic is. And I'm afraid unavoidably, when you're looking at this society and where the dynamic is, you are looking at relations between the two communities. What I tried to point out in last year's report was that actually, if you look at people's sense of themselves and their national identity, the census showed that, you know, some people feel themselves to be British, some people feel themselves to be Irish. But then there's a third constituency who don't feel themselves to be either British or Irish. They regard themselves as Northern Irish, which is situating yourself outside of that sort of binary divide. And so, you know, in a sense, we're all minorities now. You know, no matter which group you're in, there is no single majority in any of these situations. What we have to do is to learn how to live together in this new dynamic where there are three, not two groups. And
yet so many of the indicators of what's wrong with aspects of society, mm-hmm. whether it's health or education or employment, there are very stark differences when you do drill it. The stats may look bad
yeah.
overall, but actually it looks much worse when you start to look yeah. into the differentials between different groups.
Exactly. I mean, when you look at, for example, let's use the figures I referred to earlier, the ones on educational attainment. If you see that there's a marked differential developing like this, you know this is not the way to build a society. We don't want to see the two communities developing at different speeds, because we know whenever that happens, you get a tension between the two. And whenever you've got an inequality, even if it's arrived at accidentally, it's still a problem. I mean, when you looked at patterns of inequality in the past, you would always have discussed them in relation to discrimination. Well, we don't do that anymore because there isn't any discrimination of any political significance any longer. But the blind forces of the economy can reshape the economy and the society in ways that no one intends. I mean, if we get, you know, massive job losses in a particular area that's made up of one community and we get investment in another, this isn't going the right direction. So we do have to keep an eye to, well, what are the trends? And that's what the Peace Monitoring Report is about. It's trying to kind of take a health check and to see if there's anything that's not necessarily that visible on the surface, but it's a bit like your health check. I mean, if you sort of spot that the, you know, you've got a rise in your cholesterol, you're going to say to the patient, well, if you don't take care of that, that could become a problem somewhere further down the line. So you try to look at the warning signals, and the report's built around an indicator framework where we look at the economy and we look at the society, we look at education, and we look at all of those sort of leisure activities as well to see, are we mixing more as a society, or are we growing further apart?
Two things to finish. Who do you hope will read and benefit from the report? You put an enormous amount of work in each year to collate the stuff together and find the kind of stories in it. But, I mean, who do you hope you influence through the either people agreeing or disagreeing with your narrative and accessing the stats and thinking about it?
Well, I think, you know, a little humility is in order here. That if you produce a report that's 184 pages long and it's full of statistics, you're not going for a mass readership, really. But what we hope is that people who are concerned with the health of this society, particularly the politicians and the policymakers, will actually read this and notice what's happening, and that they will kind of, when they develop their politics or their policies, that they'll try to use some of this as an evidence base for whatever way they want to shape the future.
Peace monitoring reports are something that tend to be kind of produced in peaceful times in kind of post-conflict societies. Mm. We're not alone in the world. Have you a view on how this one fits with other kind of countries and where we are on our... Is there a peace journey that is common across in terms of kind of economic or kind of sharing in different kind of zones? How do you kind of relate us to the bigger picture in the rest of the world?
Well, last November, we hosted a seminar on peace monitoring across the world. And so we had people participate from South Africa, where they do a post-conflict monitoring process. We had people from Germany. We had people from the Global Peace Index. We had people from the Middle East. We had a whole, you know, as you say, this type of thing goes on across the world, but everyone does it differently because every situation is different. But what we were interested in was to try to see, well, how does artwork correspond? Actually, this is the only one which attempts to put everything in between, you know, the same set of covers, i.e. looks at attitude surveys along with the economy, along with statistics for public order. Some of the other ones focus mainly on attitude surveys or focus mainly on the security situation. But this is the one that... The only one which actually tries to put them into one integrated analysis. But in terms of overall development, I mean, what is emerging is a pretty clear trend, is that where peace deals were built on the same type of model as Northern Ireland, not necessarily inspired by it, but the same type, i.e. you try to get everybody into one coalition government, that those settlements are developing problems because the mutual vetoes end up in a kind of political standoffs. They end up with kind of administrative stagnation, and they end up with kind of dissatisfaction with government. I mean, that is a general trend. And what we're seeing in Northern Ireland isn't actually that different than elsewhere.
And the flip side is then that conflicts which ended up with one group that was a majority end up forcing their way through a bit more stable or a bit more settled?
But not necessarily better. I mean, conflicts that end up with a clear winner. That's not a good outcome either. The world is complex. There aren't any easy answers on conflict. I mean, Northern Ireland has been held up as the model, whatever we think of it here. I mean, it has been held up as the best case example of a successful peace process. Now, this past year, we've received a warning from a number of informed commentators, not least Richard Howes, to say that Northern Ireland is losing that status, and I think that's a wake-up call.
And your indicators kind of start to show that there's plenty of room for worry on many levels.
I'm afraid so.
Paul, thank you very much.